Pain takes away power. That's just what it does. It makes us feel like our bodies and our lives are out of our control. And when we teach people about the pain dial, what we're actually doing is saying there are many, many things beyond what you imagined that we can do to change your pain.
This is Meaningful Medicine. In a challenging and unpredictable world with high burnout rates, this is a podcast where incredible individuals share their most meaningful patient experiences and focus on those moments of positivity and joy that sparked their love of healthcare and changed the way they practice medicine.
Hi, I'm Nicole Hohenstein, and I'm an emergency medicine resident at UCSF.
Hi, I'm Shiva Kayambashi. I'm a doctor and professor of family and community medicine at UCSF.
We're the co-hosts of Meaningful Medicine. We created this podcast to highlight stories of healthcare professionals who have found a sense of meaning, resilience, and joy in their work. Hi, Shiva. How are you doing?
Hi, Nicole. I'm feeling pretty good today. Thank you. How are you doing? It's Friday.
I am feeling great. Friday, fun day. Have a vacation next week. So I am feeling very wonderful. Happy to be here with you. I am so excited to tackle this topic of pain psychology. Working in the emergency department, having gone through medical school, oftentimes patients' pain is really described in kind of two buckets. The patient's pain is either acute or chronic. And oftentimes we're given a lot of pharmacology that can help theoretically mask some of the pain, given other methods like acupuncture, meditation, but I don't know if we've actually really talked about what the true causes of pain are and really how to think about and treat pain in terms of trying to treat the root causes that are causing the pain to continue on and become this chronic pain cycle. And so just from my experience, whenever we get a patient in the emergency department, I hear people say, oh yeah, this patient, you know, they've come in the last 3 months. This is their, 10th visit. It's a chronic pain patient, and kind of brush them aside. And this is a hard situation because these patients don't want to be spending their time in the emergency department. Oftentimes are desperate to get relief and are miserable. And I think having providers brush them off and not give them the time or the empathy kind of perpetuates the cycle of adding on to the pain, really not addressing the root cause, not helping the patient. And I think it's hard for both providers feeling like they're helpless in the situation and patients feeling helpless. So I'm excited to really learn more and think about pain in a different way.
That's such a great overview of how you're seeing it in the emergency department, Nicole. Thanks for sharing that. And I have been a person who experiences chronic pain. I just don't want us to think of these as people who are not us, because they include us. I actually had chronic back pain for several years that was related to a herniated disc. I'm not alone. The more I bring that up, the more I hear from friends and family and patients and colleagues that they also have, for example, chronic back pain or other chronic pains. So I just want to make sure that I'm not talking about them versus us as clinicians. We are all experiencers of pain if we're human. In primary care practices, when we have a person in front of us who is experiencing chronic or recurring pain, I feel like the empathy and the pain management, we think of somewhat separately, and the empathy is more about how it's affecting the patient. I haven't thought until we met Dr. Rachel Zoff, our guest today, that the emotional experience of pain isn't only a consequence of the pain, but actually can be a cause of the pain or a magnifier of the pain. And I'm very excited to share with our listeners her perspective and her experience as a pain psychologist.
Without further ado, I'd love to introduce Dr. Rachel Zoffness. She is a leading global pain expert and thought leader revolutionizing the way we understand and treat pain. She is a pain and health psychologist and works as an assistant clinical professor at the UCSF School of Medicine. Dr. Zoffness is the author of the Pain Management Workbook, a treatment guide for healthcare providers and adults living with pain. Dr. Zoffness serves on the board of directors of the U.S. Association of the Study of Pain and consults on the development of integrative pain programs around the world. Welcome, Dr. Zoffness.
Thank you. It's so nice to be in conversation with my physician colleagues, and I'm very committed to amplifying this pain science awareness and knowledge in the medical community, and I'm grateful to be here.
We are so happy to have you with us, Dr. Zofnis. When we begin our interviews with our guests, we always like to start with asking our guests if, in short, you could share a meaningful episode sometime from early in your training that was particularly impactful or a formative kind of experience.
Oh, yeah, totally. So I've always been a nerd, like probably everyone listening to this podcast. And I wanted to live at the intersection of medicine and neuroscience and science writing and pain education. And when I finally went into private practice, one of the first patients that UCSF sent to me was a child who had been in pain since he was 16, and he had been in pain for 4 years. And he was largely in bed. And just to describe him briefly, he had long unwashed hair and he was heavy and overweight because he didn't move his body and he was pasty and pale. And he sat on my couch and he rocked himself back and forth with pain. And I remember thinking to myself, I studied pain neuroscience as an undergrad and I've been doing this work and I have had pain my whole life on and off. But his case seemed so extreme and he had been through Stanford and UCSF and seen all the doctors and had been on 40 medications. And I was like, who do I think I am? I'm not going to be able to do this. But as you know, one of the most important things we have to give our patients, especially patients with chronic pain, is hope. Without that, we've got nothing as providers. So I told him I could help him. He just had to do everything I said. And it took a while to investigate what was causing and amplifying his pain. But we did figure that out. It took a little while. And he had been depressed and socially anxious and suicidal, but that had been sort of cast aside as, like you said, sort of secondary to his pain and unrelated, just like a side thing. Like you treat mental health separately from treating the body, which it turns out with pain is absolutely positively incorrect and not the way we want to treat pain at all. So I had him go through this pain management protocol, which ended up being the pain management workbook. And I want to say clearly, I didn't make it up. I'm not one of those people who pretends that I developed a new treatment. Like there's no Zofnis method. That's not a thing. Cognitive behavioral therapy for chronic pain has existed for a very long time. Mindfulness-based stress reduction is another treatment for chronic pain that has existed for a very long time. Pain neuroscience education is a component of pain treatment that has existed for quite a while. So in combination, these treatments or orientations to pain are what we delivered to our 16-year-old. And the first week he was told by me to get out of bed and stand on his porch in the sun. That was literally just the first week. And he did that every day. And by the way, it was hard for him. It was not trivial for him to get out of bed and go stand in the sun. People who have been in bed for 4 years, that is a lot. Week two, he had to walk to the corner mailbox and mail a letter. And by the way, this was in concert with training his parents about pain and giving him some pain management techniques and teaching him about how pain works. And then week three was walking around the block. And I should say, his goal explicitly was to go back to school and play soccer again. So I told him that that's what we were going to do. Once he was walking around the block, then he was walking to the dog park with his dog. Then gradually he was mixing in jogging. And we got him a tutor so he could start catching up in school. And he had been very isolated. We were reconnecting him socially with his community. And the more he did, the more he realized he could do. And pain volume slowly started going down. Anxiety and depression slowly started remitting. And of course, all of those things are connected, and we're going to talk about how. But what was pretty miraculous for this kid was that he felt really helpless and hopeless. He had been through these wonderful pain treatment programs, but had really primarily only been on medications. And again, mental and physical had been separated out for him. So watching him get better was a game changer, not just for him and his family, but also for me as a provider. And I believe in this work. As someone with pain, I have used this myself. But watching a child get out of bed and go back to life and go back to high school and go back to soccer and get asked to prom by two girls, not one, two girls, and get his life back was really life-changing. So that experience was really formative for me as a provider. That was about 10 years ago, and it totally changed my life.
Incredible. Oh my gosh. I am probably echoing all of our listeners, but what an inspiring story. And the fact that you made such an impact and could follow him throughout all the stages and really see the growth and What an incredible experience. Thank you so much for sharing. I'd love to hear, you know, pain psychology is this topic that when we're all thinking about what to major in and what fields to go into, I don't know if I ever really thought about pain psychology as a field that you could go into. And I'd love to know really what sparked your interest in this field of pain and health psychology.
Many people have never heard of pain psychology because in Western medicine, we have this erroneous idea that your pain is either physical and you see a physician, or your pain is emotional and you see a therapist or a psychologist. And according to the science of pain, that's never true. Pain is always both physical and emotional. It's processed by the brain and the brain's emotion center. In particular, pain psychology sounds like a thing that shouldn't exist, because why would a psychologist be treating pain? And that's the question I get asked the most, by the way, when I tell people what I do and I say, I'm a pain psychologist. People say, oh, well, do you treat physical pain or emotional pain? And now I just nod my head and I say yes, because that's the truth about what I do. And that's the only way pain gets better. So my interest in pain sparked as an undergrad at Brown University. I was studying neuroscience, I was studying human biology, I was studying psychology, and I wanted to do everything. And my mentor, who has since passed from cancer, who I love, Marjorie Thompson, said, you know, there's this guy in neuroscience and psychology who studies the neuroscience of pain, and I wonder if you should talk to him. And I was simultaneously learning in my neuroscience class about the neuroscience of pain. And it seemed to live at the intersection of everything that fascinated me. And full transparency, I have always been scared of pain. Pain is a naturally aversive experience. We are all built to be at least a little bit scared of pain. And I was also a child with chronic pain. I had chronic abdominal pain and stomach aches, and I went through all the medical things. I went to a million GI doctors and had scopes and procedures and was on medication, and it was a disaster. And if anyone had ever explained to me that one of the number one signs of stress and anxiety in children was stomach aches, perhaps I could have avoided that misery. So it really galvanized me to come out here and talk about this overlap between physical and emotional pain. But it took me a while to figure this out. So pain psychology is a division of health psychology. So you can become a clinical psychologist. So I went to Brown for my undergrad, did some research at NYU, and went on to get a master's at Columbia in psychology and education, and then did my PhD in clinical psychology. But it took a while for me to figure out that this was the specialty I wanted to do. There's not that many pain psychology programs. There's not that many health psychology programs. It is very specialized, but you can, this is not rocket science, and it is not beyond anyone. So I do not want to talk anyone out of pursuing pain psychology. And I also want to say, you do not have to be a pain psychologist to do what I do. Anybody can do what I do, obviously within a certain framework, but I hand the workbook, the pain management workbook, out to PTs and OTs and nurses and physicians and every patient. So nothing that I do is beyond anybody.
That is very inspiring and hope-giving. And listening to you, I feel like we learn a lot. And I think you're right. I think we can do this. I think with a new sort of mindset and a new understanding, I think we can all help our patients and ourselves access the important concepts that you're teaching, and that will change our experience of pain in a big way, really fundamentally. And I wonder, Dr. Zafnis, if you could talk a little bit about two things that I felt were new to me a bit. One is about the pain volume, and the other is about the pain recipe. Could you share a little bit about that?
I'm constantly thinking about how do we deliver pain science in a really digestible and approachable way. And the reason I'm thinking about that constantly is because most of our healthcare providers are not trained in pain. In fact, 96% of medical schools in the United States and Canada have zero dedicated compulsory pain education. So when I think about pain education, I am directing my beam at our healthcare providers. And by the way, it's not just medicine. Like, there's even less pain education in the rest of the disciplines. As you guys know, doctors are the first line. You're the first people we see when we have pain. It's extremely worrisome to me that there's pain education lacking across healthcare. But the other reason I'm always coming up with these metaphors and these concepts is because, you know, people with living with pain, it affects everybody. Nobody escapes. I mean, all of us at some point are going to have pain. So I loved your point that you made before, is that there's no such thing as a pain patient, like on the left, and a provider on the right. we are all at some point in life going to be a pain patient, as are the people we love. So this information is critical for everybody to understand. So the concept of the pain dial is the way that I like to deliver pain neuroscience. So I'll give you that metaphor. I want you to imagine in your central nervous system that you have what we're going to call a pain dial, and it operates much like the volume knob on your car stereo. You can turn pain volume up and you can turn pain volume down. And there's a lot of things that change pain volume, as we all know, including medications change pain volume, right? But three things in particular change pain volume that we don't talk about very much. One is stress and anxiety, which we all intuitively also know. Another is mood and emotions, and another is attention. So three things. Here's how this works specifically. When stress and anxiety are high and your body and your muscles are tense and tight and your thoughts are worried, your brain, which is the part of your body that processes pain, not your knee and not your back, sends a message to the pain dial amplifying pain volume. So pain feels worse when we're stressed or anxious. And we all know that. We all remember during our training programs when we were studying for exams and we hadn't gotten enough sleep, pain volume was amplified. And during the pandemic, we saw massive, massive spikes in chronic pain and in opioid overdoses. And that is not a coincidence. Stressors amplify pain. Thing two, emotions and mood. So I like to think about that sort of on like a high-low spectrum. So when our mood is low, we're miserable and depressed, it turns out that our limbic system in our brain sends a message to the pain dial amplifying pain volume. So when emotions are negative, pain volume is amplified, pain feels worse. Thing three we said is attention. When we are home and in bed and focusing on our pain and missing out on work and life and activities, our prefrontal cortex, which also processes pain, sends a message to the pain dial amplifying pain volume. So pain feels worse when we think about it and when we focus on it. But here's what's critically important for us as providers and for our patients also, because we said hope is one of the most important things we can give people with pain. The opposite is also true. So when stress and anxiety are low, our muscles are relaxed, our thoughts are calm, our brain sends a message to the pain dial, lowering pain volume. Pain feels less bad when we're managing our stress and anxiety, when we're using these really annoying, dorky strategies like relaxation and diaphragmatic breathing and mindfulness-based stress reduction, which has mountains of evidence supporting its efficacy. And not for nothing, we know that muscle relaxants are also prescribed for pain. So relaxation will lower pain volume. Thing two, we said emotions. So when emotions are positive, again, our spectrum, positive to negative, when emotions are positive, we're feeling happy and joyful, we're engaged in pleasurable activities, we're experiencing gratitude. Neuroscience says that the brain, our limbic system, will lower pain volume. Pain feels less bad when emotions are positive. Thing three is attention. We all, of course, know this, especially during the pandemic. When we are distracted and we're focused on something else, the prefrontal cortex will lower pain volume. And that's the reason, of course, we shove screens in kids' faces when we need to give them a vaccine. Because when we are distracted, turns out the prefrontal cortex lowers pain volume and pain feels less bad. So the reason I like to give that metaphor is for a couple of reasons. One, it stops framing pain as a purely biological, biomedical problem, because pain is not ever a purely biological, biomedical problem ever. It's always biopsychosocial. And so when you deliver this metaphor, what you're doing is setting up for your patients clear evidence that pain has cognitive factors, it has emotional factors, it has behavioral, social, environmental factors as well. So that's what I like about the pain metaphor. The other thing I like is that it puts power and control back into the hands of people with pain, because pain takes away power. That's just what it does. It makes us feel like our bodies and our lives are out of our control. And when we teach people about the pain dial, what we're actually doing is saying there are many, many things beyond what you imagined that we can do to change your pain.
As I mentioned mentioned earlier, I feel so powerless when it comes to treating pain, especially when it's chronic pain. And I love the idea of having more tools in our toolkit to be able to offer our patients the empowerment to be able to do something about their pain. So thank you so much. Speaking of kind of the cognitive and emotional factors involved in pain, I'd love to understand, what does the role of compassion and empathy play in your process of understanding and treating pain?
To your point at the beginning, I think chronic pain patients are often stigmatized. And again, by that, I mean all of us at some point in our lives. But there's this belief that patients are often given this idea that the pain is all in their heads, or it's psychosomatic, which has become a bad word in medicine. I happen to love the word somatic. It turns out that all emotions are somatic 100% of the time. What do I mean by that? If you've ever had sweaty hands or a racing heart when you were nervous, that is a somatic expression of an emotion. Emotions are physical 100% of the time. Everything is somatic. That's just how the human body works. The brain and body are connected 100% of the time. People living with pain are often told, this is all in your head. And that's what's hard about my job too, is the second they're sent to me, I'm a pain psychologist, that reinforces this idea, this concept, like, oh, it's just psychological. When we express compassion and when we express empathy, what we're really doing is saying, I see you, I hear you, your pain is not all in your head. And part of what I do is to provide this pain science education upfront to everyone who walks in my door, as young as age 8 and as old as they get. I'm always delivering this because I have no traction as a provider unless my patient understands pain. And I think one of the ways we want to cultivate empathy, and one of the ways we want to change this framework that we're working in, which we know isn't working, is by framing pain as a biopsychosocial problem rather than a biomedical one. And I'm not sure we're going to make any progress without that.
I really appreciate hearing the way you say so clearly and emphatically, the mind and the body are connected 100% of the time. That emphasis on 100%. It's not just sometimes, and all these signals are going back and forth in both directions. And I really just appreciate being reminded of that. And the idea that anything is, quote, just in your head is just something that I hope we're all trained not to ever say to any person. But I'm sure that a person, they either hear that or they think that that's what their doctor is saying, as you said, by referring to a psychologist or by suggesting psychological methods of healing your pain, because they want to emphasize, you don't seem to understand, doctor, my pain is right here in my back. And you're telling me to go and breathe more deeply. I don't really, you know, I don't think you get it. Obviously, you don't understand, or you've never had pain, or you're misguided. I need something to treat here. So that emphasis, I think, is really clear from you. And I wondered if you could share what some common misconceptions are. Maybe you could separate both from the person experiencing pain's experience, as well as the clinicians who are taking care of them.
You know, your questions are so good, and I have so many things to say about all of it, so I'm going to try and rein myself in. But one of the most important misconceptions that I'm constantly trying to explode for my physician colleagues and partners who I need desperately is this idea that pain is a purely biomedical problem and that it lives exclusively in the body. And it's easy to believe that, right? Like, for patients and providers alike, when our back hurts, it's easy to believe that the pain lives exclusively in our back. But science says that's not true. And one of the reasons we know this is because of a condition called phantom limb pain. When someone loses a leg and they continue to have terrible, terrible pain in the missing body part. And if you can have terrible leg pain in a leg that is no longer attached to your body, that tells us pretty definitively that pain does not live exclusively in the body or in the part that hurts, and rather that pain is constructed by the brain. And again, the fascinating thing about the brain is that there is no one single pain center in the brain. That's not how pain works. Pain is a diffuse neurological process. And of course, what that means is there's lots of parts of the central nervous system that are contributing to the pain experience: the spinal cord, prefrontal cortex, cerebral cortex, limbic system. All of these things are working together to create the pain experience. So pain is always cognitive. Pain is always emotional. Pain is always contextual and environmental. We know that circumstances always change the pain we feel. So that's the other thing I'm always trying to disrupt, is this idea that pain is not just biomedical, it's biopsychosocial. And I just want to say what that means briefly. Yes, of course, there's biological components of pain. We all know this: tissue damage, system dysfunction, inflammation, diet, exercise, sleep. Critically important when it comes to pain, and no one would deny that. But it turns out that what science says, pain is biopsychosocial always. So there are also psychological components to pain, even though that word is so stigmatized. And what I mean by that is cognitive components of pain matter all the time. Again, attention always adjusts pain volume, and emotions always adjust pain volume, and behaviors, how we navigate or cope with our pain. It turns out staying inside and staying in bed actually makes pain worse over time. Going out into the world and doing small bits of activity, getting some sunlight and seeing friends will lower pain volume. So coping behaviors change pain. So in this psychological bubble, there's all these factors that neuroscience says are critical to pain production and pain reduction always. And then we have the social or the sociological domain of pain. And that can be very confusing for people. Like, why is there this social domain of pain? So it turns out that the worst punishment you can give a human being is not Thanksgiving traffic, and it is not prison. It's solitary confinement. What does it say about human beings that the worst thing you can do to us is isolate us from others? Turns out that's just straight up biology. So again, biopsychosocial, but they're all interconnected. So here's the biology. When we are with other people, because being social is adaptive and it is genetic, our brains produce all of these chemicals that make us feel good: serotonin and dopamine and oxytocin and endorphins, which, by the way, are our natural painkillers. So in the presence of others, our brains produce all these chemicals that make us feel good and that lower pain volume. In the absence of others, like when we're isolated, like say during a pandemic, all of those chemicals crash and we feel terrible. But pain is always social and sociological. If you are in a toxic relationship, or you're in a toxic environment, or you're the victim of racism, or you cannot afford food and adequate nutrition, and you do not have quality access to care, of course that changes pain volume. So one of the biggest myths about pain that I'm constantly trying to explode, both in the patient population and in the provider population, is this myth or this idea that pain is just anatomical, it's just in the body, it's just physiological. And this idea that pain is just biomedical to be treated with pills and procedures. That is not what pain is, and that's not how we treat pain. Pills and procedures alone are not the treatment for chronic pain. That doesn't mean they can't help, but treatment alone must be biopsychosocial, because pain, by definition, is a biopsychosocial phenomenon.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Where we as educators, as physicians, but also as patients, where can we find resources to better educate ourselves about pain?
So there are a lot of resources out there, but there's not enough. It turns out that the science of treating pain is both complex and simple at the same time. So I want to go back to the question you asked me about a pain recipe. So just as there's a recipe for brownies, there is always a recipe for pain, always. And what I mean by that is, there's a constellation of biopsychosocial ingredients that goes into creating a bad pain day or a high pain day, always. So an example: poor sleep, crappy diet, high stress, sitting in one place all day, like sitting at my desk, really bad, like intense work deadlines, family conflict, or the opposite, overusing my body and doing too much. That would be an example of a high pain recipe. And what you notice about that recipe is that there's social ingredients, there's cognitive ingredients, there's emotional ingredients, and there's biological ingredients, always. And what's cool about the pain recipe concept is that just as there's a high pain recipe, there is always a low pain recipe as well. And a low pain recipe is just the opposite. So I always have my patients write out their high pain recipe, and they don't always know. So I have them track bad pain days, and I ask them to help me think out what some ingredients are in each domain that might contribute to a high pain recipe. And once we have that written out on a piece of paper, we can look at that piece of paper and puzzle out what we need to do to make tomorrow a low pain recipe. And that includes good sleep hygiene, making sure I'm not just eating potato chips, helping people get out of bed and go outside and stand on their porch, even if it's just for 5 minutes, helping them move their bodies and find ways to move that are either not painful or the least amount painful, and getting them support, like providing them PT and OT, which I love and recommend all day long. So what's really important to me is that no one ever walk this road alone. So there are a ton of resources out there. I have a very nerdy website. It's just my last name at zofness.com. And there's a page of resources I've been putting together for 10 years with websites and journal articles and guided audio for pain and book recommendations. There's a million things on there for providers and patients alike. So that's thing one. Thing two, everything that I do in my office, I put into the pain management workbook, which is on Amazon or on the New Harbinger website. They're my publishers and they're lovely, and it's like $20. And the reason I did it is that I'm motivated both by passion and also by anger. It is not okay that pain management is inaccessible to us as providers and to patients. It is unacceptable that what I do is not reimbursed by insurance. It is unacceptable that only rich people can afford adequate pain care. None of that is acceptable. So everything that I do is in a book, and it can be used by any provider and any patient with any kind of pain. Recommend for pain, cognitive behavioral therapy for chronic pain. And I just want to say that's different than regular CBT. Most of us have heard of CBT for anxiety and depression and trauma. But CBT-CP, CBT for chronic pain, is a little bit different. People who are trained in therapy or psychological programs are often scared to provide chronic pain treatment because they believe they don't know how. Again, we have this divide in medicine. Either pain is physical or it's emotional. And a lot of our mental health professionals have not been trained in pain. So sometimes I will refer patients to CBT therapists in the community, and I will say, hand them this workbook and ask them if they'll walk through it with you. Same with PTs and OTs. I always want them on my team. I also refer people to biofeedback. And I want to briefly say what biofeedback is, because a lot of people haven't heard of it or have heard of it and don't really get what it is. So when I first started doing this work, someone said to me, you should send your patients to biofeedback if you're treating chronic pain. And I said, I do not send my patients to anything that I do not understand. So I myself went to a biofeedback provider named Dr. Pepper, which is of course a great name for a doctor. And Dr. Pepper sat me in a chair and he said, I am going to teach you to warm your hands to 90 degrees. And I am a chronically cold-handed person. And it turns out that's a sign of stress and anxiety. I did not know that at the time. But when our bodies are in a state of chronic stress, fight or flight, we know the blood rushes away from our extremities and to our core, which is why people who are stressed and anxious often have cold hands and cold feet. And we've all heard of cold feet. That's a thing that happens sometimes before people get married. So stress and anxiety, of course, affects our physiology, back to that thing where the brain and body are always connected. So he said, I'm going to teach you to warm your hands to 90 degrees. I said, look, I'm a neuroscientist. I don't believe in voodoo or magic. He said, that's cool. Sit down in this chair and I'm going to use some strategies with you and teach you how to do it. So he had me use a lot of relaxation strategies and in biofeedback. So I'm using diaphragmatic breathing and progressive muscle relaxation. He also had me rehearsing things. It's called autogenic training. So I was saying things to myself like, my hands are heavy and warm. My hands are heavy and warm. By the way, I know how wonky this sounds, let me just say. And then he was using guided imagery with me. So guided imagery. Also, this is going to sound wonky, where he had me imagine hot air flowing from my shoulders down my arms into my hands, hot soup flowing down my arms into my hands. And it turns out, if you've ever had a nightmare, you know that the thoughts in your head also affect your physiology. If you've ever woken up sweaty, your heart is racing and your breathing is rapid, you know that the thoughts in your head and the images in your head change your physiology. So He's having me use these images. And as I'm watching the screen, remember, I'm connected to this biofeedback machine. And I should say, the biofeedback machine was reading in real time my heart rate, galvanic skin response, skin temperature, and muscle tension. So I could actually see, as I was using these strategies, what was happening to my body. And as I was doing all these things, my hand temperature was gradually going up. And it took 2 sessions for me to be able to warm my hands to 90 degrees. And now I can do it on command. Now, what does this have to do with pain? Science says that thoughts are always connected to our physiology. And one of the most important things we can do for our patients is teach them that, again, that the brain is connected to the body and you have some control over your body using your brain. So when I teach biofeedback to my patients, often, especially the kids, what they'll say is, oh my God, I can make fireballs with my hands. What else can I do with my mind? And that's really all we want for people living with pain, is to believe that they have control over their bodies. So I love recommending biofeedback. So there's a ton of resources out there. No provider should feel alone. It is very hard to treat chronic pain. And part of the reason it's so hard is because none of us have been given sufficient pain education. So hopefully this podcast will go out into the universe and be disseminated and do something about that.
Dr. Zofnis, could you help us with some language on how to talk to a patient so we don't lose them, so we don't have them think that what we're saying is your pain is really psychological and it's not real and physical? How do we phrase it so that the patient understands that we understand it is very physical and there's more to it without losing them?
I love that question. I think there's a lot of ways of doing it, but I want to say first, it's very hard to deliver this information in an acute setting. So if someone's having a pain flare or, you know, they're in the emergency room, it's very hard to sit with them and explain the pain dial. Usually the way I present it to my patients, I say, I know you've been suffering for 10 months, 10 years. Has anyone ever explained pain to you? Guess how many people have said yes. Pain has been explained to me. That's correct. The answer is zero. No one has ever said to me, yes, pain has sufficiently been explained to me. So you get to ask up front, hey, has anyone ever explained pain to you? You've been in pain for all of these years, so much suffering. Has anyone ever explained it to you? Would you like to know? And everyone says yes. I've never met anyone who's like, no, I don't want to know what's happening to my body. So then you get to be the provider who explains pain, and it's illuminating and it's a paradigm shift for everybody. The other thing I recommend is when and if you refer to someone like me, a pain psychologist or a biofeedback provider, or you recommend anything that isn't a pill or a procedure, one thing I like to recommend is calling people like me pain coaches. Because there's so much stigma around psychology. And the way I frame it is this: if it is okay to go to a soccer coach to get better at soccer, it is surely okay to go to a pain coach to get better at navigating and living with chronic pain. Because living with pain is really hard and you deserve support. So I want to give you some resources that will provide you with some coaching. Here's a book. Here are some providers who I know and like who do these things that can help lower pain volume. And if you've explained the pain dial, I always frame everything as this is a thing that's going to help you lower pain volume. That's always how I frame it. So it takes some of the sting and the stigma out of it. I try very hard not to use the word mind, not because I don't believe in the mind, but you don't want to ever give this idea again that pain is in your head. So I default to neuroscience. I always talk about the brain. That is also a trick or a tip. I always am just explaining how the brain works and the relationship between the brain and pain. And I take mind out of the equation because that's more of a squishier term and it can lead to some confusion and misunderstanding. But the most basic thing that we can all do is say up front, I want to make sure you're not hearing me say that I think the pain is all in your head. Your pain is real. I believe you. I know that your pain is organic. People will say that to me. My pain's real. My pain's organic. So I just head it off at the pass and I say, I believe you. I know you're suffering. I know your pain is real. I know this isn't all in your head. And pain is a biopsychosocial phenomenon that's produced by the brain. So if we want to really lower pain volume, here are the things we need to do to help you feel better.
The power of communication and language. I absolutely love that. So with these patients, so let's say I do get chronic pain patients in the emergency department and I want to refer them to a specialist such as yourself, how do I do that? And is it often covered by Medi-Cal, Medicaid? A lot of my patients tend to be on the more low income side.
Thank you for asking that. Now we're stepping into this territory where I get enraged by our broken system. So there's a couple of issues that we have here. One is that no, pain psychology is frequently not reimbursed by insurance. You can have pills and procedures all day long. Those are reimbursed. But for obvious reasons, because pain science isn't taught, there's not enough advocacy for these non-pharmacological biobehavioral treatments to be reimbursed. So hopefully we can all advocate for that change. So that's problem number one. And again, also why I wrote the workbook, because no one should be without resources, providers or patients alike. Problem number two is that most therapists are not trained in pain. And again, this goes back to this divide in medicine. Either pain is physical and you see a physician, or pain is emotional and you see a therapist. So most therapists are not trained in pain. So when I try and refer to colleagues, there just aren't that many out there, and it's infuriating and frustrating. There is an organization called the American Association of Pain Psychology, and they're based here in California. So people can Google American Association of Pain Psychology, and there's a list of providers, and they are often not in network. Because another problem is that psychologists and therapists are not well reimbursed by insurance companies. So many of us opt to not be on panels because we cannot afford rent for our offices, because reimbursement rates are so low. So there's many, many, many problems with the medical industry and the healthcare system. It's very profit-driven and profit-focused. But it's my hope that the more we talk about this and talk about the issues that there are around pain and pain medicine, the more progress we can make.
Absolutely. I'm just taking that all in. There's so much that needs to happen to change the environment in which we are all working to make the real things that work be accessible. Dr. Zafis, pain is such an understated subject in medicine, as we've talked about, and there's so many misconceptions. What would be something that you would like more of our medical trainees and providers to know? What kind of advice do you have to give them when it comes to treating patients with chronic pain?
I think the number one thing I want to say is that it is really hard to treat chronic pain patients, and it is really frustrating. And that's something I see across the literature, is that a lot of providers find it really challenging and frustrating. And I just want to validate the crap out of that. And the reason it's so challenging and frustrating is because, again, 96% of medical schools have zero compulsory pain education. How are we expected to treat a thing that we don't sufficiently understand and haven't been trained to treat? Most of the time when I do grand rounds and I present pain science, I get a flood of wonderful emails from my physician partners saying, like, this is a paradigm shift. Why didn't anyone explain this to me? And so it's not your fault. And it is understandably very hard and very frustrating. And the other two messages: pain is a biopsychosocial problem. It is never purely biomedical or anatomical. And if we really want to treat pain, we have to look at the whole person, including their environment. We have to look at their toxic relationships and whether or not they can afford care and whether or not they can afford food and nutrition. So it's a whole person problem. It's not just a knee problem.
Thank you, Dr. Zafis.
We are just so grateful for everything that you do, and we hope that you continue to do, because we really do need you.
It's mutual. I need you guys even more than you need me. So thank you for having me on.
Thank you for tuning in today
and allowing us to be one of your meaningful moments.
Please rate, review, and subscribe, and share with friends, family, and colleagues. Meaningful Medicine was produced by Shiva Kayambashi, Nicole Hohenstein, David Elkin, Nikki Elkin, Ahaley Chattopadhyay, and Lei Kodama. Editing by Nicole Hohenstein, Nikki Elkin, and Lei Kodama. Intro and closing by Daniel Wendling. On Meaningful Medicine, we are careful to ensure that all stories are compliant with healthcare privacy laws, and details may have been changed to ensure patient confidentiality. All views expressed are of the person speaking and not their employer.